Hello, good evening, and welcome. I'm Alec Hogg, and this is your BizNews Briefing. Well, Bronwyn Nielsen has been holding the fort over the past couple of days while I visited family in KwaZulu-Natal. Lots of interesting issues going on there, which we will no doubt be covering in due course. But tonight, it's all about Gauteng. The mayor of Gauteng, Celia Brink, was duly ejected, as had been telegraphed some time ago, when Action SA, one of the coalition partners over the last 18 months, decided to withdraw from that coalition and join instead with the ANC. Now, this is interesting because Panyaza Lesufi, who is the leader of the ANC in Gauteng, is accused of all kinds of heinous things. And you'll hear more about that as we go into this evening's program. But the key story is that Dr. Nasipi Moyo, who was previously the deputy mayor, and prior to that, actually for 10 years, a member of the Democratic Alliance, has been appointed as the mayor. She's from Action SA, and the DA's mayor is going to be confining himself to the opposition benches in future. But let's pick up on that story immediately, and indeed, the issue of Panyaza Lesufi with the Democratic Alliance federal chair, Helen Ziller. Here's what she had to say about the goings-on in Tshwane, and in particular, today's appointment of a new mayor.
There is a major divide between Lesufi and the National Executive Committee of the ANC and even the National Working Committee of the ANC. And it is an absolute tragedy that the one province which is the engine of South Africa's economy falls under a person who's beholden to the Alex Mafia and who sits at the apex of interlocking networks of criminal syndicates, is all I can say, who are all looking for their access into the capital flows to loot. Now, the interesting thing is that the ANC was determined to put up their own mayoral candidate in Tshwane, but they couldn't agree on who the mayoral candidate was or should be. So a group in Tshwane had their choice, Lesufi had his choice, the National Working Committee had their choice, and they were at loggerheads and at war. And in the end, they had to all take their second choice, which was Nasipi Moyo from Action South Africa. So that is how the war is raging there. Now, Nasipi is a nice person. She's a lovely person. But quite frankly, she's going to be at the head of a maelstrom in which the EFF, various factions of the ANC, and all sorts of other people will be demanding their pound of flesh. And whether she can keep a lid on the situation or hold all those strings together, I have my very fundamental doubts. So we're going to take a capable young woman, and she is that. I'm not going to take that away from her, and destroy her in a context where she will find herself ridden over roughshod.
What happens now to the former mayor, to Celia Brink?
Well, he'll lead the opposition there, you know. I mean, he's not a prima donna. He says he's going to run the best opposition South Africa's ever had, and he will. He's highly intelligent. He's a very good natural leader. He loves Tshwane. I mean, all of those attributes. And while we're at it, can we please find a duplicate of Celia Brink for Johannesburg and Ekurhuleni? Please sell all your BizNews followers. We want the very best, passionate, hardworking, committed people to be mayoral candidates for us in Johannesburg and Ekurhuleni.
The reason Helen Ziller put that in at the end is that she told me in the interview, and you can get the full interview on BizNews TV and on BizNews Radio, is that today she approved a Facebook advert calling for candidates to join the Democratic Alliance and indeed to take over as the mayor, perhaps in Ekurhuleni and Johannesburg. Why this is so important is that Helen Ziller is part, her party is part of the Government of National Unity, and that is what at the moment is giving so many people so much hope, but it clearly is not moving all the way down to the provinces and in this case to the metros. So who is Panyaza Lesufi. Is he really as bad as some people are making him out to be? Well, Barry Bateman is with the Private Prosecutions Unit at AfriForum, and they're going for Lesufi. They've got a whistleblower who says that he has been protecting corrupt actors. My colleague Chris Stain spoke to Barry today.
Well, the allegation is that despite numerous reports, forensic investigation reports that uncovered serious corruption, fraud, and money laundering within the Department of Social Development going as far back as 2017 financial year, the Office of the Premier, Mr. Panyaza Lesufi, has allegedly taken decisions within the department so as to not hold those implicated officials accountable. In fact, the 13 officials that were suspended on the basis of these reports, the suspension started in the middle of last year. There were suspensions earlier this year. Those suspensions have in fact been lifted. The officials are all back at work. Now, this is widely reported. The officials are back at work. And they are back once again in charge of dispersing and engaging with non-profit organizations worth hundreds of millions of rand. The further allegation is that, and you know, the Gauteng department spend, or the provincial government spends a lot of money commissioning forensic investigation reports. They get these findings, which make adverse findings against officials, but further reports are commissioned to review the previous reports, because what we understand in the allegation is that where there are adverse findings, you commission somebody else to review until you get a favorable finding. So it's all part of an attempt to try and make these allegations go away. We say that there must be criminal prosecution. The disciplinary internally must proceed. And if there has been a failure in terms of the law by the senior officials, including Panyaza Lesufi, to report specific crimes as is required, they too must be held accountable.
There's nothing more powerful than the truth. We've seen this time and time again in South Africa. So it will out in this case. There is no doubt. Moving on to business now. And there were some shock numbers, well, for most of us anyway, from a blue chip of the mining industry, Afrimat. And I got hold of Andries van Heerden, who's the chief executive of Afrimat, primarily because it's such a good company, usually. And now its trading statement says that headline earnings per share are going to be down 80% in the 6 months to the end of August. Interestingly enough, the share price dropped from 66 Rand 30, where it traded yesterday, on the news, all the way down to 62 Rand 80, and then bounced straight up again. Now, that's unusual, but it does tell you that people are seeing through the noise. Let's hear from Andries what happened to cause such a massive reverse, the worst ever in a near 20-year history that this company has been listed on the stock market. It's been grown from 0 to 10 billion rand. The full interview, is, incidentally, is also available on BizNews TV and BizNews Radio.
It was almost a perfect storm with three blows that came at once. The one was that ArcelorMittal, who is one of our really big customers on our domestic sales of iron ore, had a freeze of their, of two of their kilns, and we lost quite a significant amount of sales to them in the first couple of months of this year. That had a significant impact. The second thing was on the export line, we saw a bit of a deterioration on the volumes that, that Transnet could transport for us. And at the same time, we saw the international iron ore price retracting by a good 25%, and the rand strengthening. So that that combination also had a had an impact on our income. And then thirdly, with our Lafarge acquisition, we took over on the 1st of May, and the cement business was in a really bad state when we took over, and we've been making losses in that business for a couple of months, and that's also now starting to turn. And I think the market can see that both on the Mittal side, we've seen that correction, and the volumes are back. On the cement side, we've made very good progress, and I'm expecting that turn to, you know, to happen. If not this month, hopefully next month we'll see that turn happening. And even on the export side, we saw on the back of the Chinese economy, the recovery there, we saw a recovery on the iron ore price. So I think that's probably what the analysts see. And it was, you know, we also went out on a sense earlier this year, you know, sort of just highlighting that we had those impacts. And I think the market has already, sort of discounted that in.
Today's market commentator is Peter Armitage from Anchor, the founder of that company, which is going through a merger at the moment with another business that we know well, our friends in the UK, Credo. There, Dion Hoss and Jared Kahn, good friends of BizNews. And as far as Peter Armitage is concerned, he did some very smart moves ahead of the election and made some pretty sizable bets on behalf of clients. They have a portfolio. They run about 130 billion rands worth of funds on behalf of clients. But one of their long-term holdings, even before they made those bets, is in Afrimat. So I asked Peter in the course of our conversation what he thought about the financial results that came out today from that company.
Yeah, I think they've been quite good at communicating. And I think, you know, we've been heavily invested in it. Our clients have made a lot of money out of it. It's been a fantastic share to be invested in. And we communicate often with management. And I think they signal things quite well to the market. They're good at investor relations. They have investor days. The story of Afrimat has been a fantastic management team that's managed to get assets that other people have kind of lost interest in or not focused on and really extricate value out. The previous 6 months had a very high average iron ore price, and the global iron ore price is low. But there's a lot of projects coming on stream, which will, you know, if you just base the kind of cumulative volumes of what they're producing, a year ago we did the calc, that was 100. In 2 or 3 years' time, that's going to be 300. A lot of projects on the go, a lot of value being created, which isn't yet reflected in earnings. And, you know, what was particularly severe in this time period was actually not being able to sell the iron. So ArcelorMittal locally didn't buy for quite some time period. And then they've obviously had the export rail issues. And those are things which will reverse. Arcelor got over their local issues. Rail is getting slightly better off a very bad base. But you've got their new projects and volumes coming through from other mines over the course of the next year or two. And then, you know, interestingly, they bought Lafarge for effectively 100 million rand. That's an asset when it's humming. And if you go back 10 years ago, that was worth billions of rands. So if they, you know, they continually find these gems and opportunities, they're not without their risks because they're buying assets that other people haven't really been able to do well out of. It's not always that. You know, they've bought some stuff with their mining and getting stuff out the ground for the first time. But it's a management team that's got one of the best track records on the market over the course of the last 10 years. There'll be times when the things are out of your control that you can't make better. But I think the share price reaction, I think for somebody who doesn't know the company and looked at what came out today, they would have expected the price to come up 25%. But I think, it was, obviously, when things are bad, companies don't give you inside information. We were not expecting the extent of the profit decline, but they've given the market the information and knowledge and picture of their business over the next 2 or 3 years. So we don't ultimately think the long-term value of the business has changed because of a very poor six-month period. And that's really what the market's telling you in terms of what the share price has done today.
So with Peter Armitage, before the election, as mentioned earlier, he took some big bets. They did a blitz, as he calls it. And again, you can watch and read the and listen to the full interview on BizNews TV and BizNews Radio. They did a blitz on 30 South African companies and found there were a handful of them that were worth investing in. I asked him this in the context of the big news story, as we would have seen it, of today's JSE, where Mondi PLC, which used to be part of Anglo American, made a 12 billion rand acquisition of various assets in the packaging industry from a German company called Schumacher. But Mondi is so non-South African that it falls outside of what we call SA Inc. Its operations are pretty much European and outside of South Africa, whereas SA Inc. are those companies that are very focused on this country and then stand to benefit if the government of national unity holds, economic growth improves, jobs are created, and we move off the bottom with an economy that grows at least by 3%, not the 1% we've seen over the past decade. And that's the area where a lot of smart investors have been investing their money. So I asked Peter to tell us a little more about SA Inc.
Yeah, I think SA Inc., depending on how you categorize it, is about 50% of the JSE, and banks are about 25%. So banks are about half of it. You then take out insurers, so kind of the more traditional non-financial services SA Inc. companies are probably around 20% of the market. And, you know, we're not a bulge bracket enormous asset manager like a Coronation or an Allan Gray. You know, there'll be five or six asset managers in the SA who have people intensely looking at something like a Mondi. But we'll tend to focus our efforts on areas that we think look interesting. You know, for the last 10 years, looking at construction companies was a bit of a waste of time in South Africa, and they all just went down in a straight line and delisted or went bankrupt. But obviously, as the South African scenario has changed, we've spent a huge amount of time starting about a year ago looking at SA Inc. companies. The valuations were very low, and it became clear that if there was some kind of trigger to unlock the GDP and subsequent earnings growth from these companies, there could be some big opportunities. You know, you're now paying about a 28 multiple for a US company, and you're paying an average of 10 or 11 multiple for a South African company. So you're paying less than half. And if they can get the earnings growth coming through, there has been good money made. And this year, for the first time as anchor, probably in 7 or 8 years, we've been more positive on SA assets than global assets, largely based on price and valuation. You know, the global prospects in America look excellent. But boy, you're having to pay up for those prospects. You know, things don't come cheap when they're looking good. And SA, you know, yet opposite scenario, things are looking quite dire. People didn't really care about the valuations. So, you know, we went in a blitz just before the election, doing analyst visits with 30 of the South African companies that we thought could benefit, updated our knowledge on those. And, you know, we found a handful of companies that we wouldn't have invested in for the last 5 or 6 years, have performed very well and we think will continue to do so.
Can you share any of those names with us?
Yeah, the smaller companies, you know, obviously besides the bellwethers in the top 40s, Sun International, Southern Sun, Lewis, We Buy Cars, Afrimat is an interesting one. We've been invested in that as a smallest SA company, more than mining space. Yeah, but those are the and famous brands. So companies that, you know, high quality businesses with long track records that were simply stuck because South Africa wasn't growing. And, you know, the interesting part is the government of national unity can look so clever because there's things besides them and the confidence levels that they're creating. And it's almost coincidental that will really benefit them. So the, you know, if you look at load shedding moving away, the economic cycle. So interest rates have just started coming down, which is a big boost. The two-pot retirement system will push 50 to 100 billion rand of money into consumers' pockets. So, you know, they've got all of these things that can really help them. So they're sitting in a good place if they can get it right. And obviously all the South African fund managers are cheering them on, hoping that the worrying headlines that you have seen every few weeks about the tensions, and probably will continue to see until the end of this initial term of the GNU. We hope that's just part of the growing up process.
Well, another part of the growing up process, if you're a young journalist, is to follow some of the big stories. And that's what our colleague Asima Nyeda has been doing with the BHI Ponzi. You might recall that a gent by the name of Craig Warriner, who is very intimately involved with St. Stithian's School and the Old Boys Association, managed to suck in a lot of money from people who trusted him and worked a lot of his distribution network through an organization called Local and Global. Local and Global, for those who live in Johannesburg, had the branding all around the Mill Park, the old metal box head office in Mill Park, and it was, for all intents and purposes, quite a reputable and large organization. Indeed, just before the collapse, it had a joint conference with Alan Gray, pulling in Alan Gray's reputation and brand to continue in its nefarious ways of funding this Ponzi scheme. Anyway, Asime has put together a terrific piece on BizNews TV. It's well worth watching. It chronicles the whole BHI story. And he did a little cut for us today, which we're closing off the program with. Have a listen.
In the heart of South Africa's financial landscape lies a dark story of deception, greed, and shattered dreams. The BHI Ponzi scheme. This scandal has defrauded investors of over 2.8 billion rand, leaving hundreds in financial ruin. At the center of this web of deceit is Craig Warriner, the mastermind behind BHI Trust. Once a respected investment manager, Warriner orchestrated a scheme that lasted over a decade. In May 2024, he was sentenced to 25 years in prison after pleading guilty to 207 counts of fraud. But the story doesn't end with Warriner. Michael Haldane, founder of Global and Local Investment Advisors, played a critical role in promoting BHI's fraudulent activities. His connections and promises of high returns drew in unsuspecting investors. Arrested and released on bail in June 2024, Haldane maintains his innocence, but was recently debarred from providing financial services for 30 years. David Shapiro, a seasoned investment analyst, commented on the impact of such schemes.
I think the warning signs are the statements that you receive. You know, I think that's where it starts. You've got to ask, where my shares? You know, what worries me is the structure. This is at the back of my mind. If it was a trust, who owns the shares? Was it the trust and therefore you're just a shareholder? Or were those your shares? In other words, you know, we're holding it on your behalf. These are yours, ring fence, pigeonhole. And that's when you deal with us, you deal with any professional, you know, investor, coronation, whatever it is, you've got access to what you own. And you know that this has been held on your behalf. It's the one thing that started in 1987 was a very important regulation that came out. Your client's funds are ring fence. You cannot access it. And that's important to know. I want to see my shares, or I want to know where my shares are. I want to know where my money is. And we don't ask those questions. And I think this is perhaps the naivety of the people that they prey on.
So how does a Ponzi scheme like BHI work? It's a deceitful cycle of attracting investors with promises of high returns, using new investments to pay old investors, creating an illusion of profitability. Eventually, the scheme collapses when the operator can no longer recruit enough new investors. As the court prepares to resume next week, the case continues to expose serious vulnerabilities within South Africa's financial system. The need for improved regulatory oversight has never been more critical. The saga of the BHI Ponzi scheme serves as a stark reminder of the devastating consequences of financial fraud as the search for justice continues. Victims are left grappling with the aftermath, and the quest for accountability remains ongoing.
Thanks, Asime. Well, this has been your BizNews briefing, and it reminds me of one Mr. H.S. Patel, a lawyer who sent us a rather threatening letter early on in the BHI story saying that it was all about speculative comment and watch out. Well, that's been the briefing. Until tomorrow, cheerio.